Hey, this is Blake.
This is Jake.
Welcome to episode 3 of Breakfast with Blake and Jake.
And good moment wherever this meets you, at whatever place or localization in the space-time continuum. Greetings.
So we're going to continue on with this new ritual of introducing the importance of hydration. If there's any water in your vicinity, go ahead and grab yourself some filtered water. Take a sip of that. And we're going to read a quick benefit. Hydration has a major effect on energy levels and brain function. Your brain is strongly influenced by hydration status. Studies show that even mild dehydration, 1 to 3% of body weight, can impair many aspects of brain function. In a study of young women, fluid loss of 1.36% after exercise impaired both mood and concentration and increased the frequency of headaches. Another similar study, this time in young men, showed that fluid loss of 1.59% was detrimental to working memory and increased feelings of anxiety and fatigue. A 1 to 3% fluid loss equals about 1.5 to 4.5 pounds of body weight loss for a 150-pound person. This can easily occur through normal daily activities, let alone during exercise or high heat. Many other studies, ranging from children to the elderly, have shown that mild dehydration can impair mood, memory, and brain performance. The bottom line: mild dehydration, fluid loss of 1 to 3%, can impair energy levels and mood and lead to major reductions in memory and brain performance. So on that note, let's go ahead and drink us some water.
Cheers. The next thing is, we had talked about the importance of, oxygen and water starting the day. So to continue that trend and that ritual, we're going to do some breathing. Now, another benefit of breathing is breathing releases tension. And think how your body feels when you are tense, angry, scared, or stressed. It constricts. Your muscles get tight and your breathing becomes shallow. When your breathing is shallow, you are not getting the amount of oxygen that your body needs. So on that note, we're going to just take 10 deep breaths in before getting started to facilitate the oxygen and reduce any of our stress or anything that we're holding on to and just generally get feeling good. So on the count of three, breathe with us. So 1, 2, 3. I think that's 10. Thank you for breathing. And remember, if you ever are feeling any tension or anger or any kind of emotions that don't feel good to you, either biologically, spiritually, or mentally, what always helps me in my experience, I can't say this for everybody, but if I just stop and breathe for a second, usually it will reduce the effects of those emotions on myself. So it's an easy thing to do. It's probably one of the simplest, most beneficial things you can do outside of, drinking water is a little bit more complex because you have to find the water, but there's always some degree of oxygen all around. So remember to breathe.
And also, stemming from the idea of any anger or undesirable emotions that we might be experiencing, I can say approximately, actually, within the last 24 hours, I was experiencing some pretty heavy emotions. And my parents reached out to me and just asked if I had a few minutes to talk. And naturally, in an environment where we've curated relationships, you know, where thoughts are welcomed and, you know, good relationships where people feel that they are comfortable expressing themselves, I naturally began to kind of speak and think out loud about some of the things that I was going through. And by the end of the conversation, I was actually feeling a lot better about some of the emotions that I was experiencing. And I realized that through speaking about what I was feeling and actually talking out loud, I was able to make some sense of it. So breathing is definitely an antidote to those types of feelings, as well as finding a partner or even being your own partner in that journey of speaking out loud and attempting to make sense of it. And ultimately what I came to is I realized I've been feeling a little bit of a lack of community. And I think we all desire a sense of belonging and we all desire to be a part of something bigger than ourselves. You know, that's a common element in the human experience. And through last night's conversation, I just realized that I've been a lot more focused on turning inside and reflecting introspectively and spending time with my ideas more so than actually spending time with people and spending time collaborating with other people. And it was good for me to be able to breathe through that and speak out loud and realize it's not the end of the world. All it is just an opportunity to shift and adjust. And on that note, I've got a quote to kick off the episode for you guys. Quote, "Things happen for a reason. You are sure of it. You are sure of it because in your soul, you know that we are all connected. Yes, we are individuals responsible for our own judgments and actions, but nonetheless, we are a part of something much larger. Some may call it the collective unconscious. Others may label it spirit or life force. But whatever your word of choice, you gain confidence from knowing that we are not isolated from one another or from the earth and life itself. This feeling of connectedness implies certain responsibilities. If we are all a part of a larger picture, then we must not harm others because we will only be harming ourselves. We must not exploit because we will be exploiting ourselves. Your awareness of these responsibilities creates your value system. You are considerate, caring, and accepting. Certain of the unity of humankind, you are a bridge builder for people of different cultures. Sensitive to the invisible hand, you can give others comfort that there is a purpose beyond our humdrum lives. The exact articles of your faith will depend upon your upbringing and your culture, but your faith is strong. It sustains you and your closest companions in the face of life's mysteries." End quote. The Gallup Strengths Finder.
I like that. It's very, very provoking. Indeed. So what is that? What does that mean to you?
Well, in my experience, I feel I've been striving to consider my roles in life, right? Like, we want to get clear on our roles so we can understand what kind of responsibilities we do have. And I found that I often thrive within roles where a part of that job or purpose that I'm playing is the opportunity to listen to other individuals and to essentially counsel as well, and to help, you know, form the connections and connect the dots, if you will, between all of these miscellaneous elements and thoughts that someone might be having. And I think one of the reasons why I enjoy that so much is because I oftentimes see myself as I see those opportunities and those experiences and conversations as a place to draw inspiration from when creating. Because we're all so far, far more connected than we really realize. And I find if I'm able to empathize in the moment and really listen and connect with an individual, I might be able to express that part of the human experience through my music in a deeper way than if I hadn't taken the time to really listen and connect.
That is interesting. So you're finding that probably a key component in your writing process is like human interaction is very inspiring to your process of creation.
Certainly, human interaction is crucial. And Logic actually talks about that in his most recent Grammy Award winning record, 1-800, and it's the suicide hotline, right? The record is it was essentially dedicated to suicide prevention and awareness, and the song Logic speaks a lot about the fact that it was one of his hardest records to write because he actually had to speak with and go to a place of an individual who was feeling like they wanted to die, you know. And as an artist, Kendrick talks about it, and really many philosophers talk about how important it is to represent, you know, the culture and society that we live within. But in Kendrick's words, essentially, like, as artists and individuals, we have an obligation to act as a voice or a vessel through which the larger context of society may express itself through. And suicide and you know, depression and drug abuse, these are all issues they're eating at the core of the youth within America, and I think really the world today.
Yeah, and I think too, the principle of empathy is, you know, essentially the idea is putting yourself there. The more you can place yourself there in any one person's shoes, you're really experiencing not another human being's turmoil, but you're really experiencing your own, linking it to the connectiveness, right? And so going to those places, even expressing through those places or imagining from the perspective of those places, is really allowing you to empathize with that aspect of humanity and consciousness, which we are all part of, you know. And we believe, I guess, we do believe in like a golden thread, if you will, that connects all people synergistically. And I think that because of our intellectual endowments, there is a lot of confusion that's still being worked out. Though we have made a lot of progress, I think it's different than if you look at, you know, in our kitchen, we've got like ants that are coming in for food source in our kitchen. And if you look at the ant organism, I was just telling Mark that it's like they're all so unified in their mission, right? Like the colony of ants, they all know their roles, they all know where they work, where their biological endowments, it's like a subconscious thing, like they know what role they're supposed to play. And there's different roles and hierarchies even within an ant colony, but they're all working toward one thing, and it's almost just completely autonomous and subconscious, right? And so, you know, I think that we should look at ourselves more that way, with this great ability of self-awareness, because they just do, you know, they're born and they just do, you know. And we have autonomous features that regulate like our biology and all that, where we breathe, for instance. Like, we breathe maybe not in the most useful way we possibly could all the time, but we're always breathing or we wouldn't live, right? Mm-hmm. We wouldn't persist to live. So, if you look at somebody who is experiencing that really dark aspect of their nature, and you even spend time with that person, and you're becoming more intimate with that aspect of your consciousness, and that's the most effective way to communicate, to be able to communicate, or to take that and transmutate it into something that could be a creative work that could help people understand that aspect of themselves. But also to be able to relate with that individual, right? Effectively. And going that place with ourself. And there was something that a mentor that we've been studying, we've been just getting into studying lately, is Brett Weinstein. And he said something on the Waking Up with Sam Harris podcast that I found really very interesting, which was that he does a lot of analogies to rooms and kind of equating the compartmentalization of his mind to different aspects of his existence. So he says he has this thing called the jihadi sandbox, which he likes to play in. And basically when he's playing in the sandbox, and it's a kind of an imaginary fictional place that he likes to go to so as to develop his empathy toward basically the antithesis of his belief system, right? This is like, this is an ideology that is basically has no, on at least on the surface value, at very least, has no, nothing in relation to him. You know, he was raised like in a Jewish family, and the jihadists, you know, have a, the extreme jihadists like have an animosity or an animus tone toward the Jewish race, and they, you know, for whatever reason, they believe them to be a threat to themselves. And that's a whole separate conversation. But he goes to this place simply to experience that truly polar opposite aspect of his nature. And everything that is kind of opposite to himself. And thereby so to understand. And that way, when he does encounter someone like that, or he is communicating in regards to someone like that, he has a far greater appreciation for their perspective, even if he doesn't agree with it, you know. And that allows for at least effective communication, which can then lead to a at least a mutual understanding of the other side. And with that being said, if you can accept, if you can at least, at very least, accept their side but not agree with it, then you've made an immense amount of progress in how people view each other, you know? What do you think about that? Does that...
It's a brilliant idea, you know, especially the idea of naming, you know, these different realms that we're deciding to step into. You know, he called that the jihadi sandbox, and there's actually a lot of power and strength associated with actually naming certain aspects of our human experience. You know, one of the psychologists that we listen to, Jordan Peterson, talks about the benefits of such a process. And the reason why it's so beneficial is because now we have some context and an arena to play within, right? You know, if we know the name of a certain phase, or let's even just continue with the jihadi sandbox idea, if we know that the idea of the jihadi sandbox exists, then it's more solidified, something that we can actually contextualize and, and step into, as opposed to this just infinite, you know, sea of energy and potential influences, and trying to understand, you know, a perspective can often, it can often be a very deep and introspective process. And when we're going through that type of thing, we want to make sure that the only variable that's coming to play in that situation are the variables that we're aware of,
mm-hmm.
you know, at least to the best degree possible. And that's the benefit in really setting the intention of any action, is getting clear on what variables and emotions are coming into play. Can we do our best to take emotion out of the picture and just step into the jihadi sandbox?
I was just going to actually contribute to that point of that. That's exactly the same thought that was very well articulated, of just, that's the best way to set our emotional attachment, which can be very convoluting to us really openly interpreting a situation, right? You could have all these emotions at play. You could have, like, you know, if one was raised in a certain religion, I feel as though there is some kind of pride maybe associated with that, you know, and that's just one of many examples. Or just, you may feel like your religion is something that is so much more progressive, and even you could even posture it as being superior to another religious belief. And so just, it could be even just that separation of, like, comparative analysis that would say, oh, you know, my religion's so much better. So the only way, if we seek to become this, even if it's in an imaginary way, and with the term imaginary, I mean, oftentimes imaginary can be more real than real, because everything that we see, utilize, or experience in the physical world was a thought before it was a thing in some human mind. And that's a quote from this book that we study called The Master Key System, which was written by Charles Haynau in the early 1900s. But he says that, you know, everything we see around us created by human agency had first to exist in some human mind. Therefore, thought is constructive. And so, with that being said, you know, and I feel that there's a lot of truth in that statement, you know, that it is very constructive and objective, because it's like the very first singularity upon which something becomes manifest into the physical plane, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, going there into our imagination, and it's kind of this combined process of, you objectively are looking at the religion, getting to know people, spending time with people in other religions to really get an essence of who they are, because looking strictly at literature or ideology in your own somewhat biased interpretation can be misleading to the representation of an individual who holds those beliefs if you were in the context of one-on-one, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
You may meet somebody who is considered a extremist, or somebody who is considered an orthodox, which we were discussing before recording this earlier this morning. And you might think, like, I was under the impression, and maybe this would be a good time for you to talk about this, but I was under the impression, like, I realized I had a bias form that an Orthodox Jewish individual would be kind of not accepting to the Reformed aspects of Judaism, right?
Mm.
And you kind of helped to sort that out for me, because that's not something I'm very educated on. But you grew up in the Jewish faith, so maybe you could comment on that aspect.
Certainly. So the Orthodox tradition, or oftentimes it's referred to as the Hasids or the Hasidic tradition, it is a mystical Jewish movement that was founded in Poland in the 18th century. And it's essentially a sect of Judaism that pulls largely upon the actual original text and is very diligent in its practice of the original text. And furthermore, though, there is an interpretation of the text that is referred to as the Kabbalah, and it's a Jewish mystical interpretation of the Torah. And essentially, the Hasids are known, to my understanding, from those of which that I've met and interacted with, are known to believe highly in the mystical power of oneness and being, which is mm-hmm. a common thread within all sects and forms of Judaism.
So, if you don't mind me to interject right there, empathizing with the other person's perspective, like we were just talking about, mm-hmm. you shared a story with me, which I'm sure, you know, you may or may not have been leading to, but there's a really great story about your experience with those of like the Orthodox faith, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a great example, I think, to correlate really getting to know like the importance of one-on-one interaction and connectivity, right? Because then you can kind of dissolve any biases and you can get a real feel, right? Could you tell that or share that story? I think that the listeners would be interested in that.
Absolutely. So in January or in February of 2017, I took a trip from Los Angeles to Melbourne, Australia. And I was flying on a plane about maybe 11 hours into my flight, and the sun was beginning to rise. And a man about four or five rows ahead of me stood up, turned towards the window, opened the window, and began praying. He was wrapping tefillin, which is, they're small leather boxes that are, there are Torah scrolls within the boxes, and there's an imprinted symbol on each box, so that when you wrap the tefillin around your arm, the symbol is imprinted upon or binded upon your hand and your forehead. And this is something that in the Orthodox tradition is practiced every day, wrapping tefillin. And it's a way to just acknowledge and intimately interact with something physical to emphasize, you know, the connection that we have and the deeper spiritual, you know, importance of these principles. But point being, I felt compelled to pray as well, but I had packed my prayer book beneath the plane in my carry-on suitcase, or in my stowaway luggage. And after the man was done wrapping tefillin, I approached him and just communicated that I really admired his discipline and his commitment to his faith and practice, even amongst, you know, a plane of a couple hundred individuals. And he asked me if I wanted to wrap tefillin. So we proceeded to wrap tefillin, which is something I had actually only done once in my life about 5 or 6 years prior in Israel. And it was really special. There was something really special about just feeling the blood rushing from my arm, because you're in a sense, it's kind of like a blood pressure
Pressure meter that uses like air pressure to gauge your vascular like force or something like that.
Exactly.
Quote us on that.
It's the same sort of sensation, because you're wrapping this leather band all the way around your arm. I believe you wrap it 13 times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cutting off your circulation, so that your heart is actually pumping harder. It's working harder.
Oh, and wow.
And so these signs are being bounded upon your wrist and your forehead. And it was just this amazing experience that actually dialed me in a little bit deeper into the functions of my body. And we were up in the air and I was connecting with this man. And eventually we had wrapped the tefillin and I thanked him and I exchanged information with him. And he actually ended up connecting me with an entire community of Hasidic rabbis and people of the Hasidic tradition. So during my time in Australia, I once a month roughly would go to the Chabad, which is a temple or a space where these people would worship, and I would have dinner with them. And they were just very welcoming and open to the idea of the Reformed tradition just because they saw me as a brother regardless. You know, it doesn't matter if you were even Jewish or not. There were some people who would come and eat with us who weren't even of the Jewish faith. The one thing that remained consistent, though, was the ritual and the tradition. And they practiced the way in which they would practice independent of whether we were there or not. But what was so cool is that they welcomed us in and they gave us the chance to experience their tradition. They were open-minded about it. And what I realized is that they're normal people, you know, just like anyone else. And that's the benefit in really creating like the jihadi sandbox or maybe the Hasidic sandbox and stepping into that realm is you get a deeper sense of the fact that these are just people and this is a part of their tradition and the way they do things.
Exactly. And I think just we could do a little exercise with that right now, which is, so imagine you're on an airplane. Many people have been on an airplane or at least seen what the inside of one may look like, you know. So imagine you're on an airplane and Blake's on the airplane, and both Blake and I are very eccentric people, so we are very expressive through like the garments we wear and like the accessories and just the whole thing. Like, we kind of use our bodies as these canvases of expression, you know. So imagine, you know, a very artistic person, you know, who's very expressive, sitting next to a man who's very ultra traditional. You know, he was wearing the garments and the whole nine yards. So you see this mass. So you're seeing on an airplane this extreme polarity, and then if you place yourself in the traditional man's perspective, right? He's being approached by this other man who is just nothing. You know, he basically represents very little on the exterior, but there is a common thread between the two and a common acceptance. And, you know, that's where we have to be careful of it defaulting too much to our bias in our mind, and this is just my feelings again. I always try to articulate that as much as I can, but we have to be careful about managing our bias emotionally and all the things that we think we know against spending more time in the sandbox or whatever area that we create in the mind, or however our process of imagination is. So think about the contrast, but this man was still accepting. And I, this morning, thought, I was under an impression, I wasn't sure, that's why I asked, but I still had a little bit of a bias of a thought that maybe the Orthodox tradition did not accept the Reformed tradition, would not accept it, right? Because they're so by the book, and then the more reformed and the more adaptive that the faith and the ideology and the theology and all that stuff becomes over time, the more that it would naturally change from like the essence and sentiment in the book. And so that completely shattered my idea of this, right? Like of just by hearing you, who has actual interactive experience with people of this belief, and that they are still very accepting. So instead of us judging, or like I said, defaulting to our biases, we should get to know these people and become interested in like the aspects that make them somebody different than ourselves. Like, take interest in that stuff, but also maybe if it's something that you feel is even dark, like, you know, the jihadists, if you can relate to one of them, you know, you can basically relate to anyone, you know, and you're seek at least on a trajectory of being in touch with all the different aspects that we are. You know, we're not just something that you can describe in like two paragraphs as individuals, right? I mean, literally, it's a storybook that's, like, continually being written, right?
Right.
It's a narrative that's always being progressed.
And relative to the idea of if you can relate to one of them, then you can almost relate to anyone. You know, I think all of us desire to establish some sort of consistency within our lives, something that we can lean upon and trust. You know, that's the purpose of faith, and I think religion at large is to create some sort of structured, formatted, principle-based community that you can trust,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think the point of relation for me, like when I step into that sandbox or that arena is, and I want to use this as a way to segue into other sandboxes and what sandboxes we might currently be entertaining, but the point of connection within the realm of the jihadi sandbox is the fact that these people are striving to take what's written in the Quran and lean upon it as if it is literally the word of God.
Verbatim,
you know, and there's no room for interpretation. And I think there's a certain part of me that can relate to that because I want to be able to embrace the idea of something that exists eternally, right? Something that there's where there is no room for change, because so much changes on a day-to-day basis, like within our own selves and within society. And, you know, they say that the text never changes. The only thing that changes is you. And that's why they say that in the Jewish tradition. And that's why when you come to the Torah as a new person every day, having grown in some form or fashion, they say the Torah has 1,000 faces. And that correlates also to the A Hero of 10,000 Faces by Joseph Campbell, a very well-known mythologist that Jordan Peterson, one of our mentors, speaks about from every now and then, and he was largely influenced by Carl Jung as well. But point being, there are many different reasons behind, you know, many different traditions, and it's important for us to, or at least I would say it's beneficial, it's practical to be able to embrace the idea of these other traditions, because it might lead to something that we didn't know, and we're meant to make friends with that which we don't know, so that we can explore new territory and become more whole as individuals. And there are certain tools that we can use to essentially become more familiar with that which we do not know. We have to provide ourselves that platform, right? We've talked about the sacred journal, and something that Jake and I are exploring right now is creating that platform or that sandbox or that journal within the realm of characters. And that's been really, really helpful for us, right? If we take the same idea of the jihadi sandbox or the Hasidic sandbox and then just translate it into a character, we now have a context or a framework with which to pour all of this information into and compartmentalize this information into. And just as an example, the idea of being siloed and feeling like I was lacking community, right? Like we were speaking of at the beginning of the episode. What I realized is that was a part of me, right? Like that was a part of me that I was not really fully understanding, and not only a part of me, but a part of humanity, right? So I wrote to myself last night. I said, it's important for you to understand that this tragedy and turmoil that you're experiencing is an indication of an opportunity for you. It's an opportunity for you to further understand the weakest parts of humanity, the siloed parts. Just snap into it. Realize that you are now understanding that you've been siloed. You are siloing yourself. Creative collaboration has been limited, and it hasn't particularly been resolved. So oftentimes when we create these barriers and these limitations to for other people to enter into our lives. Or, for example, I communicated to a friend of mine this morning that I feel siloed because for some reason I don't always have the motivation to communicate or respond to text messages or just reach out to people. You know, I'm actually able to step into that sandbox of silo, right? And understand other people within history who have maybe experienced those same types of feelings. So it all comes back to empathy, like we've discussed, and it gives us a greater capacity to understand the human experience.
Yeah, and I think through our exploration and through our endowment of empathy, which allows us to take on the perspectives and to kind of look, Sam Harris said, it's kind of like you're looking at it through a canonical lens, which the word canonical is included in the list of sacred books officially accepted as genuine. So if you look at something canonically and through the lens of someone else's ideology, I think that's where the golden thread of connectivity emerges, right? Because at least in my mind's eye, I can find or extrapolate from any belief system, I can find some degree of principled archetype that is common, or that at least the ambiguous idea is common enough, where it's like I can see those things, and then those are what I feel are maybe the useful aspects of, at least I try to look at things and say, okay, well, at least I'm going to find what's useful. And I think if you have a whole, if you look at all of this sacred ideologies and the books associated with those, and you look at that canonically, you will in fact find some point of relation. I feel like that's inevitable. You know, and that would indicate based on just if you wanted to look at it analytically or from a place of reason or logic, right? Mathematically, if you see commonalities in several sacred books, then at least you can entertain the idea that very well might be something of immense value, at very least.
Right.
You know? And so I think that at very least, even if you were to not fully venture out beyond the horizon of comfortability, at least moving in that direction, you're going to yield something of value from that process. You know, and I believe that there's far more benefit just beyond that, but you could yield immense value at very least just by finding the commonalities, or even being able to recognize commonalities amongst all of them.
And the cool thing about beginning to recognize commonalities between all of these different sects or traditions or sacred books is that as human beings who are endowed with the ability to create and bring forth new ideas into manifestation, we have the opportunity to pull all of these common elements and channel them all into one saturated and localized project. And that's exactly why I feel so connected to some of these characters that we're exploring, because it's giving us a chance to get to know them. And not only to get to know them, but to really just understand more, to obtain knowledge. And it's giving us a space, like, when we step into, you know, the realm of humble savage, which is a character that is largely influenced by the Hasidic tradition and some of the ancient rabbis of the Jewish tradition. And also Maimonides is an influence, which was a Jewish philosopher who spoke largely about the nature of giving and the different degrees of giving and many other topics. Marduk is a Mesopotamian god figure that Jordan Peterson references. He says that essentially Marduk was a character within Mesopotamia that actually had the ability to speak magic. And I really loved that idea of truth and the essence of speaking truth being almost magical and mystical in a sense. And I felt that was a really common element within the Mesopotamian tradition that could be connected to the Kabbalistic tradition of mystical thought and the utmost importance of truth. So I thought, okay, well, maybe we should throw those in the same blender and just blend it up and create like a smoothie of Marduk and Mesopotamia and the Kabbalah and that tradition, and then allow Humble Savage to exist as, you know, this character who's a representation of all of it. You know, and it's in a sense giving a voice to and paying homage to all of these different aspects of the human experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's basically, you know, we call that a amalgamation of information, you mm-hmm. know. It's like an amalgamation of information. It's like all the information of your life, all the information that you have sought to know about something particularly, all the information you know about characters that have existed historically, not only historical characters, but also fictional characters. And in a sense, if we don't have the ability, there's really not much differentiation, like, besides like historical documentation. But again, that's all seen through the lens of perception, of human perception. And so it's like you learn about a character who lived 100 years ago, who has been not with us on the physical plane for a long time. That, I mean, in a sense, that's very, very similar. There's not many dissimilarities between that and a fictional character, because they're both things that you never experience on the in the physical plane intimately, like one-on-one, like as an actual individual, right? You can become that person and interpret that person, and, you know, intentionally and objectively, like, say, hey, I'm going to become this person to understand them. But you'll never have that exact, like, human interaction, like you and I talking. Mm-hmm. So, like, really, there's a lot of truth that can be had in fiction and in narratives. But it's a cool way to put everything into one. I guess it's a good idea to put everything into one. Try to sum everything in a way that's quantizable, that people can actually understand through this embodiment or this manifestation of this fictional idea.
Mm. So I have a question. I'm gonna challenge, like, just for the sake of argument and conversation, like, one of the ideas that came forth in that statement of like not ever having the opportunity to come, like, face to face with this character, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, they might be just as real and in essence just as important or influential, even, you know, a lot of the fictional characters within, whether it's even Harry Potter or A Wrinkle in Time or any of these major movies, they become influential pillars in culture that mm-hmm. that inspire people to take certain actions. But will we ever be able to come face to face with them? Like, that's an interesting idea to entertain, because, like, I'm curious to know, like, even in your experience of Silo and who Peter Silo is to you, like, do you feel that, like Silo ever speaks to you? Or like, do you think that that
is possible? Well, I think he does speak to me, you know, in a different, through a different transcendental way, but it's not, it's still, it's different than like, you know, I think he's an exaggeration of, I feel like I know him very well, right? But it's not like I'm speaking. I mean, I speak to him in my mind, you know, using my imagination and just through like meditation and stuff, and just the character and the idea and the embodiment like comes to me. But it's a different type of communication. It's no more or less significant than a real human interaction.
Mm.
But you know that you can safely say, I think, but it's not the same thing, and it's a different means of communication. Just like, you know, if somebody comes to you in a dream, it's just a different way of interacting. But I guess to say generally that you can't speak with the person would be incorrect, I suppose, because it's like, no, well, you can, just in a different way. Not in the same way specifically as you can in a human interaction.
Right. But it's a different medium.
It's a different medium, yeah.
And I think
sometimes it can be even more intimate because, like, than a human interaction. Or less, or the same. But I think it could be even more because you know deep, deep things about this character that, like, you might not get from a impromptu conversation or random conversation with an individual. Like, you may get to that point with the individual if you've known them for a period of time, and there's a level of trust and comfortability with vulnerability contextual to the interaction between the two. But I think it's just a different thing, but that's a good idea. That's a good challenged of a way to look at it. Should be more specific with, I think it requires more of a specificity of description.
I appreciate the intention just behind your articulation of answering the question, and part of the reason why I bring it up is because I feel that these characters in many ways have been, they are essentially a tool through which we are exploring different aspects of our psyche. And in the grand story, right, the greatest story known to man, just the epic that remains consistent throughout all time, there's always a hero, there's always a villain, there's always a supporting character, and there's always a guide. And within our story, Peter Silo is the villain, or essentially the part of ourselves that is the shadow that Carl Jung speaks about. And it's important for us to get to know that shadow or that character on a deep level, because whether we realize it or not, it's a part of who we are. And it's important to embrace that, because we can learn new things about our path and our journey through that. And we can actually become more whole individuals. And furthermore, the guide, what I'm getting to is the guide of our story, which we spoke of as Humble Savage. He has essentially acted as this partner or an expression of my higher self. And oftentimes, like last night, like I was feeling these heavy emotions, and all it took was for me to allow him to speak and to call upon him to ask for guidance. And that part of my psyche was then able to come forth and channel the guidance and the words that I needed to hear. So I think there's a larger like point to be made of the importance of defining and naming your guide. Who is your guide?
I've got something that I could contribute to that. So you've seen on my laptop, I make collages and stuff, you know, just because they're visual things that help me sort things out. Like they, to me, I'm a visual first, and then I can articulate. I feel like then I have a greater ability, at least in my own personal experience, and everybody operates and creates in different ways. But for me, it's like I have the parameter of the visualization, and then it opens up a very vast arena, but it's still arena nonetheless, like we talk about, right? It's this place that now, like, okay, I've got some kind of visual parameter, but there's so many possibilities now. And then I can jump into that. And so I have this collage, and basically all of the people, and this is something that we learned also from the book, The Master Key System, which it's a very deep book. If you read it incrementally and really study it, if you're interested in that kind of thing. But he basically talks about an exercise where you visualize your round table of he calls it the mastermind. I don't think he calls it this, but this is what I call it. I call it my mastermind round table. And so I have an image of these people sitting around this big table, and you know, the table's kind of floating through space, and they're all sitting around the table, and it's all of my mentors' heads I cut out, and then I put them on the bodies of the people that are sitting around the table. And so I reason why I choose these specific individuals because they're people I study a lot. So through the culmination of information that I know about them, even if I've never met them in a one-on-one situation, all the information and videos and things I've watched and interviews, right, become the embodiment of what this character or this person who actually still, many of which of those people, some of them are no longer here, but many of them still are here. But I can go in my mind and imagine, like, if I'm stuck on a particular aspect of something that I feel like is a hang up, then I try to diagnose what that hang up is. And then I will go to my mentor who specializes in that area that I'm hung up. And then I ask them for guidance. And then we sit down and we have a conversation. Hmm. And through just staring at this image and imprinting this visual in my mind, in culmination with the conscious collector of data that I've accrued surrounding the individual, and with my own, you know, cognition and my own flavor, I guess, of just humanity, of being a human being, then I can imagine this character. Mm. And then they can, like you said, like how, you know, Humble Savage speaks to you or any of your mentors, right? It's the same thing. Mm. Like I can have a conversation and then they'll usually help me to find resolve and just not, they'll help me to reduce the challenge, you know, to something that I can identify and then thereby address.
Mm. That's a great approach. I love the idea of the round table, and it brings a whole new meaning to the All Velvet Everything record that we're working on. There's a verse in there that goes, the round table surrounded by the people we love. Mm. Ground to the cloud, there are velvet curtains hanging from above. Under the table, the children read the fable from love. Ground to the cloud, the velvet curtains hang from above. Da 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 da, all velvet everything. And at this table, I had never really understood who it was that would be there. I knew it would be certain people that we love, of course, but also I think the mentors are there. So,
yeah, we love them too.
Of course, yeah. And we want to encourage you guys to think about who those people are for you that you can call upon. And then I also just wanted to create another call to action for both Jake and I and you guys, is to think about, if you were to channel all of those people and create this superhuman-esque type of individual who may have been representative of all of these individuals, who would that person be? Who would that fictional character be? So that you can get to know that individual in a very intimate way. And you will be able to call upon that person in moments in which you need them most. And furthermore, you will be able to embody that one particular individual who is an amalgamation of all of your greatest mentors. Who is that? Where are they from? What era? Just getting to know them on a deep level. And I think that's helped me a lot through every day while I'm getting to know who Humble Savage is and having a place to essentially channel these mentors and ideas into. And
I think it's important to say that if you are going into these arenas, that do it in a place that you feel is safe to begin with, because it's not something that you can expect a great majority of
people. Hey guys, it looks like we got cut off there. There's an hour limit for each segment that we record on our Anchor podcast app. But Jake was just expressing the importance of doing this type of exercise of channeling characters and parts of your psyche in somewhat of a sacred space, right? Where it's really important, or it's been really beneficial in our journey, you know, creating these types of places, intentional environments for us to experience these types of things in more of a private environment. But at the same time, he also emphasized the importance of going out and connecting as well, if you want to just reemphasize that point that you were making.
Oh yeah, I think it's it's kind of like the yin and the yang balance, you know, principle of balance. It's like, yeah, you've got to have some degree of experience and some measure of experience and social interaction to fuel the essence of these characters. And then, you know, in conjoining, there's got to be a level of intimacy and a place where you can basically finding a place where one is not influenced or distracted would be the better word to use there. Where one is not distracted by external energies and forces, where it's just you and whatever is, and or one and whatever is, and that's the place where you can have the conversation and do it completely freely, and I think get the most again intimate of a connection.
And to piggyback off that idea, I think it's important for us all to draw inspiration and influence, right, for the characters, like when we're connecting with people. But in another important reason to go out and connect with people is to be able to give to the world, right? Like we may be receiving inspiration or influence, but we're also called to give our gift. And the way in which we do that is through creating community and being a part of it and giving, you know, whatever it is that you feel you're meant to give to the world, just giving that and doing it in whatever way you can. And that's part of what this podcast is. It's a big step, you know, in the right direction for Jake and I to be, you know, attempting to give our gift to the world through sharing some of these ideas and some of the information that we've been discovering. And we look forward to doing so musically as well, and certainly we're really looking forward to performing and just connecting and going out and experiencing, you know, what it is that you guys have to bring to the table too. We're really excited to meet you guys and just share all of these ideas that we've been working on and hear your ideas as well.
Absolutely. I think that I think that's all moving in the right place, man, moving in the right direction. So
there's one more thing that I want to share that just blew my mind. There's something called the Midrash, and it's an interpretation, much like the Kabbalah, of a certain element of the Torah. And mm-hmm. I spoke with a rabbi this past week who said that there's a Midrash, or a story or an interpretation that teaches us that when we're in the womb as a child,
all of the knowledge and the wisdom of the universe is bestowed upon that child. And in the moment before their birth, there's an angel that comes and kisses them on this part of the lip that's directly below the nose. And all of their perception and obtainability of that knowledge, is it disappears. So he says the reason he said that is he looked me right in the eye and he said, so just remember that life is not a journey of learning. It's a journey of remembering. I felt it really correlated with if our lyric of grow young back into the child that you had grown from.
So it's basically we are born and in essence, the idea there is that we're born and then we've got everything, but then it's wiped from our consciousness and then we're uncovering it as we go along. And through our, we kind of uncover and then discover, and then we have this accumulation of memories that are, it's basically when we uncover something, we're remembering what we always knew. It was always there all along.
It was always there. And that could be another, I'm curious to know what that might have to do with deja vu. Like what that rabbi would have to say about deja vu. And the biggest win, like, about that perspective is that it really affirmed, like, the nature of why that first phase would be called the birth of death. You know, because it's like the death of that knowledge and the, I feel like it's an angel of death that is coming down, like, from, like, why would an angel be sent if it wasn't, like, sent from some sort of shadow, like, forced to take all of that information away, like, as opposed to give them something to strive for, but.
And I guess, yeah, that could segue into a very long conversation about just the inevitability of challenge that exists in the human existence and understanding that that is part of our nature. And that would just be an indication, that you can't escape challenges and hardships, because that's kind of the beauty, is like the journey and the uncovering and the discovery. And so, like, through maybe a dark force taking all of that away from you, which could be perceived, like, anytime we lose something or something is taken from us, especially abruptly and unawarely, that can be shocking and it can be traumatic, right? And so that would be the ultimate, like, we're not conscious, we haven't developed our consciousness to know, but, like, if we reflect on the idea of everything being taken away from us the second we're born, right? Is that, that's like ultimate strength, right? Like, it almost would have to be. So that way we could be in a position to handle everything that gets thrown at us all the time, you know, and to remain grounded. Because if we were just given everything and allowed to keep everything, there would be no experience of life. Like, we would just have everything, know everything. So taking it away from us, I think, is kind of like the beauty in it. You know, and I think if we look at that and we correlate that to, oh, why am I experiencing this challenge in life? Probably because you're going to, it's the universe or God or whatever, if you believe in some force that kind of is responsible and dictating everything that's going around us and unfolding around us. If you believe in that, then it would almost have to be that we are bound to receive something as a result of that. That's far greater than the sacrifice we made for of actually going through it, you know? There's a gift in all the challenges of life. You know, there's something we can learn to become better, so that way we can have more of an experience and uncover more of what we already knew.
Yeah, great perspective on that. I appreciate you elaborating. And in closing, we want to take a moment to just acknowledge that there are many different ideas that are being spoken and different concepts. And if one of them in particular speaks to you, whether it's, you know, the idea of anything that's been discussed on this podcast or any of the other podcasts that you guys are checking out, and you want us to expand upon it and maybe do a full episode or a series on it, feel free to reach out to us. No matter when you're finding this episode, just give us a buzz. Our Instagram is @IAmGrowingYounger. You can communicate to us through there. Or our personal Instagrams are @IAmHumbleSavage and @IAmPeterSylo, PSYLO. Feel free to reach out to Jake or I about any questions you guys have or any ideas that you have. And we really look forward to just continuing to do this. And furthermore, we're just grateful to be able to be recording this episode right now.
Yeah, and you know, just to always remind everybody, you know, these are ideas, and this is a way for us to communicate with you guys, like who we are and what we do, and it's also a way for us to understand each other more. So, you know, feel free to chime in on anything, or if you feel like, you know, it's okay if you feel like something maybe have been misrepresented, because we would love to hear your perspective on that, and we are more than happy to hear that, and just open expression, and like we always say, that you're safe with us. You can express yourself in any way that you feel is right, that you feel intuitively is right. And also, just like he said, welcoming ideas for conversations, or contributing to the conversation, or adding an element that we might not have seen. All this stuff is welcome. And just on our behalf, real quick, I wanted to make sure that I give you guys the... So for the breathing excerpt that Blake read, that's from onepowerfulword.com. There's a lot of cool stuff on there. Apparently, I haven't explored it too much to say, but I want to make sure to give credit where it's due if we're utilizing something. And then also the water reference that we read came from healthline.com. And so they have a lot of science-based stuff written in a way pertaining to, like, physical health and things like that in a way that's easy to understand. So check those out if you're interested.
And then finally, the quote on connectedness came from the Gallup's Strengths Finder book. There's a test that comes along with the book that'll give you your top five strengths, and then the book itself actually goes in-depth to each one of those strengths and gives you information in terms of action steps and suggestions for how you might be able to put that strength into action. So we highly suggest checking out the Gallup Strengths Finder as well. And any final thoughts, Jake?
Yeah, I think the two main points to contemplate, the two big elephants in the room pertaining to our conversation, is to you know, kind of seek the golden thread amongst people, to explore the idea of connectivity and how we all relate and how we are all one, you know, entity, if you will, or one organism or one being, or whatever you, however you'd like to phrase that. And then I think the second big elephant would be, how do we effectively, how do we effectively seek to understand others, but also understand ourselves? And understanding different aspects of ourselves allows us to experience others, and vice versa. So, those are the two main points I think that we covered of contemplation, is the connectivity and then the relationship of ourselves with an amalgamation of different aspects of our existence, you know, and the characters that embody that and the ideas that embody that.
Truly, yeah. The second point you made, I know we're piggybacking and you know, building a lot more of than we had originally intended with our episode, but I think it's important to just read this final quote from Dan Crenshaw. He's a Navy SEAL that was featured on Jocko's podcast. Jocko is a Navy SEAL that we listen to. He says, "If you don't give people a mission, or you don't encourage people to find their purpose and their dignity, you have a failing society. It's so important. Our policies need to promote a sense of mission for people, to help people understand that they have value in their role. They're here on this earth for a reason, and if you're not constantly seeking out what that value is, that you contribute to society, then you're not doing your job. And we need to help you do your job if need be, because you have value, and you must find that purpose in life. Guys like us can't survive without that constant mission." The idea of contribution, contributing to society, is really the element that hit home for me. And I realized last night that I think that's part of the reason why I've been feeling a lack of community, is because I have such a desire to contribute to the world with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm eager to do so, and I'm striving to cultivate patience in that avenue. So I suppose in a more universal context, if you're on a journey, which we all are, to discover why you're here and what gift it is that you've been given in order to give back to the world, you know, once you find that gift, give it back in any way you can. You know, and that relates back to the parable that we shared last week of how important it is to give your gift to the world, and just trust that, you know, in proper planning and strategizing and preparing to give that gift, you know, the gift will be returned unto you tenfold.
Sounds good.
Thanks for tuning in, guys.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.